This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Tensions over land use have periodically led to violence in parts of Africa. There have been direct conflicts between ethnic groups over resources, and government policy sequestering parkland has restricted other forms of economic development. Preservation policies have also created a poaching industry that threatens the safety of local populations. In Kenya, 10 ethnic groups have come together to find a collaborative approach to the problems. They've created the Northern Rangeland Trust. The trust brings together people connected by geography and kinship to manage their lands for mutual benefit. They protect animal habitats, negotiate grazing locations, offer economic development programs, and improve security for both people and wildlife. The U.S.-based Nature Conservancy is a partner with the Northern Rangeland Trust. Their Africa field director, Charles Ulucina, is in town for a series of events. He's going to talk with us first about the program. Charles Ulucina, welcome to the state. Thanks. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much, Frank, and I'm really privileged to be here today to share with you this changing environment that we're working in Africa, that Nature Conservancy, based on the experiences and models developed in the U.S., have been able to influence life across the oceans, and it's amazing.
I want to talk with you about just how that collaboration came about. You wrote an article about the epidemic of poaching that's sweeping Central and East Africa. First of all, let's just look at some of the issues that these, particularly these 10 groups have faced. Talk with us about poaching and kind of what kinds of threats that poses.
Well, thank you very much. So poaching is a very destabilizing event that has come to impact on the socioeconomic stability of local communities in Africa who've depended on nature and still continue to depend on it for their day-to-day upkeep. What is an elephant to a local community? An elephant is security. An elephant is an economic end in terms of tourism development. There is no single species of animal that transforms nature in a very profound manner, like an elephant. So man and this wildlife have evolved over hundreds of years in a very symbiotic fashion. So we are dealing not just with a beautiful animal sitting in a zoo, but we are dealing with part of nature and ecology that shapes the way we interact and profit from nature. Tourism as an economy in Kenya contributes up to 20% of the GDP. And you wouldn't believe just how much of value it is to a local community that probably lives below $1 a day. So the transformation that we are trying to do is institute a new way of thinking on how land is governed. And poaching has come in as a big disruptor to this successful innovation that has been growing in Africa with the likes of the work that TNC is doing with Northern Rangeland Trust. But why is that the case? We have a growing middle class in a country like China that has a lot of disposable income, and people are beginning to invest in things of peripheral value, trinkets. You have ivory chopsticks, you have ivory Buddha. So everybody wants to have something. And amazingly, a lot of them, out of innocence, believe ivory is sourced from dead elephants. That's a kind of innocent. Yet we are dealing with a very entrenched class of transnational crime here. The actors are becoming increasingly militarized. We are talking of a poaching class that is using night vision goggles to bring down elephants and rhinos in the African wilderness. And so what we are seeing here is for the last 4 years, a loss of over 200,000 elephants. This is not sustainable. This is almost immoral that if nothing is done, we will be the generation that will be held accountable watching a species go down under our watch when we have all the civilization, the technology and advancement that we have as man. And so what we are looking at is how do we work out a framework to begin addressing this destabilization that is happening because of increased poaching.
Well, you said something very important, too, at the beginning of that. We talked about the importance of that species and what a crime it would be to lose it. But you began by saying that as a community resource, the people in, and now we're just talking about Kenya at the moment, but in other parts of Africa, recognize the value of this. So for the community at large, there's already a recognition of this animal's value for a variety of reasons, tourism, it may have other uses. And then along comes this criminal class. Once the animal is commodified, it takes on a different meaning for other people. So the community is already, the local community already gets the importance of preserving this animal beyond the kind of larger sort of environmental question of saving the animal. That was already in play, that understanding, when these groups came together to come up with a, with the, their local solution. Can you tell us about that?
No, indeed. I mean, the nature of the ecology that is there in most of African countries is that people, wildlife, and the whole ecosystem have evolved for hundreds of years. They've actually been symbiotic. They have shared water points. They have shared pasture. It's only when groups, external groups, bring in perverse incentives that shift the equation that we begin seeing a shift in attitudes. So in one way, I think with this dirty money from these poaching cartels coming into Africa and taking advantages of underemployment, taking advantage of structural deficiencies within these countries to create high value to something that has, you know, invaluable. You can't value an elephant. It is God-given. It's there. It was created before man, you know, and it's our responsibility to be sure that it outlives our own existence. So you look at it that the price of ivory back in 1989 was 5 kilograms a kilo. By around 2014, it had risen to $2,200 a kilo. So that's massive. It shows you that the demand side is willing to pay anything. So we are pitted against very significant forces of a market that is unregulated, a market that is very opaque, an industry that is working through networks of distribution that are so convoluted that they defy logical market principles. And so they're arming criminal groups to come to Africa to disrupt that cycle. So society-wise, I think people see value in sustaining this wildlife and nature as it is. But as we say, the impact, the force of globalization and these criminal networks sometimes tend to override the good, the intentions that we are watching.
So when I read that story that you just laid out in the New York Times or hear it on NPR, then I immediately think, well, there must be a kind of a global approach to this. There has to be some way where that NGOs have to come together. The interesting thing about this story is that the Northern Rangeland Trust is a group of 10 ethnic groups within Kenya, and within and without, I suppose. They cross some borders, yep, too, some of those borders that had been imposed several hundred years ago. Tell us about that group, how it came together and what it did.
So that's a basic question. And one of the things that we look at on the history of doing conservation in Kenya is that historically, wildlife and people used to exist together. And then the colonial forces came into play and then national parks were created that clinically separated people and wildlife. And in the attitude of the people is like, therefore, all wildlife belongs to government and anything else is what was left for community. So the prime estate was taken up for conservation and marginal landscapes were left for the people. So despite all those early efforts, it was amazing that in a country like Kenya, 70% of the wildlife was still to be found in community areas. And those parks that were created would only hold 30%. In these areas, also we're speaking, there was very minimal of investment in terms of infrastructure, in terms of the social capital, education and health that will catapult people to the next level of social well-being. And so what it did is it spurred an underground economy that was driven by banditry, by a lot of ethnic conflict, by cattle raiding, and so coupled with drought that became cyclical. Drought used to happen once every 10, 15 years back in the 80s. In the 90s, it dropped down to once every 5 years. From around 2005, we are seeing drought every 2 years. So there are all those climatic shifts that are happening. There are the economic shifts. There are the social pressures that are happening because of a rapidly expanding population growth. And then these communities came together and said, wait a minute, we are working ourselves to extinction with this way of life. What can we do that can sustain us and sustain nature for the benefit of our people? And the answers were very close by. It's like our ancestors lived in this landscape for hundreds of years in harmony with nature, at peace with nature. This disruption that did happen was as a result of trying to institute foreign systems that were alien to us through the divide and rule. It did work at the colonial times. We have to begin find a way of working collaboratively, because in this harsh ecology, we either hang together or die together. So a group of elders came together and say, we want to set up an institution that will consolidate our collective ambition as a community of pastoralists. And starting with four conservancies back in 2004, covering barely 200,000 acres of land, it has grown to 28 conservancies covering 8 million acres of land. And this is a very interesting fact that it's a self-perpetuating mechanism, because the Northern Rangeland Trust Council of Elders, constituting of these tribal communities, has a set of criteria that you must comply to for you to be allowed to be a member. It's like a council that sets the rules, that this is the league for you to play in the league. This is how the rules would be like.
Do the rules protect species and allow for pastoral land so that animals can graze? And is there agricultural land as well? In other words, are all of these sort of needs and imperatives that can sometimes be in conflict embodied in the agreements that they've worked out?
Absolutely. The rules take the whole universe of the aspirations and land use needs of the people. They do not go profess some specific coverage that you must have an elephant for you to qualify to be a conservancy. In fact, to a large degree, conservancy is about a way of life of the people. How have we used grass? How have we shared water among communities? How have we been able to set bylaws that we as people have complied to, and therefore created a successful and progressive way of maintaining our ranglands for the people that is meaningful and is there in perpetuity? So the rules that have been set up, as I've said, are all meant to enhance that which adds value to the communities.
We are talking about creative new ways that, in fact, go back to very, very old ways in Africa to protect lands and to protect economies. And we're talking about that today on The State of Things. Charles Ulucina is with us. He's with the Nature Conservancy's Africa Field Director. And that brings us to the question, what is then the relationship of this U.S.-based Nature Conservancy and how do they fit into this picture?
Great. So the Nature Conservancy, with its 50 years plus experience in advancing conservation works around the U.S. and the globe, brings significant institutional memory, technical capabilities, and a network of experts that are able to deploy at the right places to influence decision making at the policy level and on the grassroots level, using tangible solutions that work for both community and people. So we're bringing to this movement significant technical resources around building traditional governance. We are basically reconstructing this big ship that used to operate very efficiently in the past, the traditional community systems of governance, where there is democracy and representation, participation and transparency. That's a core driver to sustaining this rangeland. It takes heavy investment. Let me tell you, in terms of the best thing you can ever buy in these groups is instituting appropriate governance structure. And that's the first takeoff point of these conservancies. It shifts the equations, because as a science institution, you would imagine that we'll be gung-ho getting there and doing metrics, doing science. Well, we realize that in the whole system analysis, the first thing that will make conservation work, it's going back to the people and redoing social engineering. And that's what we're working on as the primary foundation. If that works on the grassroots, then everything else takes off. So we are also bringing in very innovative economic tools, such as social impact investment. We're trying to mainstream right now their livestock production to a mainstream economy. This is very transformative, because in a region where previously herders will get between $100 and $120 per head of cattle after toiling for close to 5 years, we've shifted the clock and elevated the productivity of the ranglands through appropriate planning, using both traditional and modern science, and then linking them to a sustainable market that is fetching them between $250 to $300 guaranteed market price.
How did this relationship come about? Were you asked? Was the Nature Conservancy asked in? Did you find each other? How did the partnership develop?
It's an amazing question you raise, because as the Nature Conservancy was developing its global programs based on what they've done in Asia Pacific and Latin America, in Africa they scoped out specific countries where they felt that there was a real need to bring about new ways of thinking that will sustain conservation at scale. So in Kenya, for instance, we did an ecoregion assessment. We defined geographies where there are enough players, where we didn't want to go there and create duplication and competition. We took a geography where there was a lot of scope for biodiversity conservation, but nobody was doing anything because they took it to be very difficult to work in. So we chose the toughest equation and the most difficult environment to begin demonstrating change.
I've only got about 30 seconds left, but what impact has this had on Nature Conservancy in the United States, if any? Does any of what you learn in Kenya then apply and change the way things are done here?
Absolutely. As one conservancy that is networked from doing real estate development, from doing conservation science and community development, we are seeing intricate sharing of knowledge and experiences, that Africa right now is on the radar screen of how we can do conservation in a new way at scale. So what has worked in Africa is being taken up as a lesson that we will take to our programs in Indonesia, for instance, as the Nature Conservancy, talking of which I'll be going to Indonesia this December to share our experiences on conservancy development and how social impact investment is a critical driver to successful community-based conservation.
Impressive story. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Charles Lucina is the Africa Field Director for the Nature Conservancy. It's an organization that's aimed at conserving lands and waters on which much of our life depends. Thank you. Charles, by the way, has written an article for Nature magazine called The Price of Poaching, and you can find that at our website, stateofthings.org. By the way, this Thursday, in conjunction with the Triangle Leadership Forum, I'm going to moderate a panel on fracking. Free. It takes place Thursday evening at the Full Frame Theater right here at American Tobacco Historic District. And if you want to join us, just go to our website, wunc.org, and you'll have more details on that. This is The State of Things from North Carolina Public. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.